6:29, we have 1 minute. We can all wait with bated breath. The chime rolls over to 6:30.
Son for 2 days about where's his iPad at, and he can't go on electronics. Yeah. He's going to sit on the couch until he can tell me where it's at.
You know where it is?
He waited till I left to say, oh, I found my iPad.
No, you can't.
You knew exactly where it was at.
Is it his personally or is it the family?
It's his. But he's got time and he's got rules. He's got to ask us before he can take electronics.
Okay.
So that we know when to start the timer.
Right.
Otherwise, we take it and we don't know who's on.
How long does the timer run?
He gets an hour and a half during Monday through Sunday through Thursday.
Generous?
It's very generous. And 3 hours on Friday and Saturday.
So he's trying to game the system, huh? With you on your way out the door.
Yeah, and I'm a gamer. Well, not a gamer, but like, yeah. I know how to work the system. He's going to have a battle with me now.
Yeah, all right, ladies and gentlemen, my watch shows 6:30. We'd like to call the monthly Human Services Committee meeting to order. First thing we have in our docket is the roll call. Looks like everyone is here. Am I missing anybody?
Supervisor Nudo.
Supervisor Nudo, Youth and Governance is here. So let the roll call reflect all present except for Supervisor Nudo. We have now citizens' comments. Are there any citizens who would like to make a comment? You have 5 minutes to come before us and speak your mind.
Yes.
If you just identify yourself and give your address.
Yeah. Good evening. My name is Elizabeth Gilbert. I'm one of the chief operating officers with Rogers Behavioral Health and Rogers Memorial Hospital. And so I am the chief officer over West Dallas inpatient services and our partial and IOP services, but also with Kenosha. So Carissa Buchanan is the director of operations with the Kenosha day treatment programs for adult and adolescent child services. So she'll tell you a little bit more about what we offer here in your area. But we just wanted to touch base with you and possibly build relationships on working together in the future.
Yes, good evening. So Annie Berg came and met with us last week to talk about how can we further our collaboration with Kenosha County and the surrounding counties. We truly serve patients from Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties in our programs, and how can we just further the mental health services. About 3 years ago, we had a stakeholders meeting in Kenosha where we heard from the community about the needs of the behavioral health needs in this area, and we just want to continue working with that relationship. We work with Debbie Gruber frequently with the Mental Health Coalition, the Opioid Task Force, NAMI, and so we thought this might be a good place to come and share our services and then see what we can do from there to continue collaborating. So Kenosha has had behavioral health services Rogers has had behavioral health services in Kenosha for the last 15 years. We started with child and adolescent services, and now we have adult services as well. So for our child and adolescent services, we have programs for children ages 10 through 18, and we teach them a variety of skills that really focus on improving their social skills, their ability to manage stressful situations, learning effective ways to manage their emotions, and we have a huge emphasis on mindfulness, how to kind of cope in that moment and stay calm. And so these skills are very transferable to functioning in school, in the home setting. So we have a very skilled, trained, multidisciplinary staff. All of our children and adolescents see a psychiatrist on a weekly basis. There's a clinical psychologist that meets with them, as well as a team of art therapists, nurses, master's level therapists, and group room leaders that really come together and provide a very comprehensive treatment for our patients. They can come for either 3 hours a day or 6 hours a day, so we have pretty intensive levels of service. So this would be beyond going to a therapist for maybe 1 hour a week if we're seeing that there's a need for intenser level of services, that's where Rogers comes in. And we're the only location in this area that offers that intensive level of services. So we really want to be able to collaborate and make sure that people know about those services. And for our adult programs, we have a general mental health program. We also have a dual diagnosis, or a mental health and addiction recovery program, and that actually runs in the evening for individuals who are still going to work during the day, and so those programs are for individuals struggling with mental health diagnoses as well as addiction. So in Kenosha, we're able to provide a lot of comprehensive services, and then beyond that, Rogers as a whole has inpatient services in West Allis. That's our closest inpatient facility to the Kenosha area, and we also have residential services. So for individuals who potentially need detox and then a longer stay to look at addiction recovery or ongoing mental health issues, they can stay with us for residential for 30 to 60 days.
In West Allis, we have also just recently, as of the last year, we opened an adolescent dual program. So for adolescents who are struggling longer term, the day treatment services aren't working for them, that they our average length of stay is 45 days for, again, mental health, and they're starting to use substances, and working with them. In June, we're opening 28 beds for adults with the same issues. So having mental health disorders or mood disorders is along with substance abuse. So that'll be coming online in June. So
we welcome any collaboration. Like I said, we're involved in several organizations within the Kenosha community, and we have been for many years. Andy has our contact information if people want to come and tour our facilities, or if you have ideas of different meetings or organizations that we can partner with. We do a lot with KUSD. Every year we go and speak with all of their school social workers and counselors. So just kind of welcoming those ongoing collaborations and looking for any gaps and where maybe we see a need for service that we could partner and provide those services.
I'm just going to make a comment at this point. Usually during citizens' comments, we don't open it up. We don't have a discourse back and forth between citizens and the meeting group here. However, this is a little bit different situation. You're actually more of a provider, more of an institution situation, so I think it's entirely appropriate that if any supervisors have a comment or question at this time for members at the table, go ahead and bring it up.
Well, I'll ask a question. Can you explain to us what you had explained to me about the continuum of care and the insurance aspect and what you foresee insurance companies may be pushing in the future?
Sure. Rogers has done a lot with making sure that we provide evidence-based care that is effective for our patients. And so our outcome data that we collect, how we have patients complete assessments upon admission and upon discharge to say, have they improved? And so using a number of assessments, it shows that our patients overall, 91% of those patients show improvement while they are in the care of Rogers providers. That's our system as a whole. When patients step down through our continuum of care, so say they come into inpatient because they're feeling unsafe, maybe they want to harm themselves, somebody else, they need a medication stabilization. If they then step through our continuum of care, step down to the 6-hour program and then the 3-hour program before we then work with them to discharge them to outpatient providers in the community, of the patients that step down through that continuum, 80% show additional improvement in their stabilization from when they came into that first level of care of inpatient. So we're really working with our system as a whole to have patients go through what we call that clinical pathway to receive that treatment. So sometimes insurance companies say, come to inpatient for 5 days, we're going to discharge you back to outpatient. And we know that in this mental health crisis, they're going to need stabilization. So we have been fighting to say, let's keep them for inpatient 5 to 7 days, and then keep them in treatment for another 1 to 2 months. And we know that they're going to stabilize so much more in that period of time that they're going to discharge to outpatient and probably be much more successful and not come back and readmit, because that's truly our goal. We don't want to see people coming back at this acute level of care again and again. So it truly provides stabilization. So we've been able to show that data to the insurance companies and show that kind of the clinical care that we've provided with this level of care is very effective in treating patients who are.
Some of the payers have been tracking their own data and being able to show that the readmission rates when people follow a longer continuum of care, that the readmission rates for those patients are lower. So they were partnering now with some of the insurance companies to be able to look at data together and see how that is actually affecting the longer term stability for the patients in the community, which is exciting.
Yeah. Any other supervisors, comment, question?
I have one comment and one question. From a comment perspective, I'd just like to thank you ladies for what Rogers does in our community and throughout southeastern Wisconsin. I actually used to work in mental health myself, managing an assisted living home, and so some of my clients were benefited from your programs and things. So I know firsthand, you know, how helpful that can be. My question is, in Kenosha here, do you have, like you had mentioned with the stepping down system, after a while you might discharge them to like a weekly one-hour therapist. Do you offer services at that level, or do you refer out at that point, like weekly? Yeah.
We don't at this point, and part of that is Roger's commitment to not compete with the outpatient providers in the community, to be able to move them back to the people that refer to us. Having said that, I think there's a decreasing number of people who are doing outpatient, so I think it's something that we continue to kind of reconsider. Should we have a space in that market just to be able to have the patients, and with the decreased number of providers at that level, sometimes patients have a 3-month, 4-month wait time before they can get an appointment. So even if we just kind of bridge the gap a little bit to be able to still support the outpatient providers that are there, but yet have our patients not wait so long, is maybe a space we should go into to bridge that gap a little bit.
Particularly with psychiatry.
Yes.
That's a huge need in the community and the state.
Just briefly, do you deal primarily with private care, private pay patients, or are you working in conjunction with the county to take some of, fill some of its needs for social services that may be necessary? How's your caseload on that?
So Rogers is a nonprofit behavioral health hospital, and so we do accept all insurances. We have Medicaid, most of the Medicaid HMOs. Medicare only pays for the inpatient level of care. They do not reimburse at the PHP IOP, so in Kenosha we're not allowed to take Medicare, but certainly Medicaid, Medicaid HMOs, and then for inpatient, all of them, that we really work to service any patient who needs the behavioral health services.
Yeah, and I don't, from a county perspective, I guess we would have to have a conversation about if there's a gap we could fill from the needs that you see. But we don't have any contracted rates with Kenosha County that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you're referring to, it's mostly just the state level with their Medicaid insurance and HMOs that,
So maybe just bring us up to speed. You're referencing your West Dallas operation and how you have inpatient up there, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying the average length of stay is about 45 days for adolescents?
Adolescent residential.
Okay.
Yes. So the difference between residential and inpatient is inpatient has 24-hour nursing care. So think of residential like a community CDRF.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a differential between just being residential and inpatient.
Yes. Okay.
Then you're saying you'd like to expand that in West Dallas to adults as well?
Yes, we are expanding that by 28 beds.
Okay. And what is the present footprint for Rogers in Kenosha County? How does it?
We don't have any residential beds down here right now. I don't know that it's not on our radar at the moment, but it doesn't mean that it.
So that would be termed inpatient.
Yeah, we have no inpatient.
So it's outpatient.
Yeah, it's only outpatient.
And that's where it's either 3 hours a day or 6 hours a day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that you would like to have this made more available to the county board general meeting to have this brought forward?
Right. They're going to actually stay tonight and talk in during the comments. I can talk to the chairman and see if he can maybe extend it out a little bit.
Very well.
Maybe for some questioning. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for attending and coming before us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Item number 4, approval of the minutes. I trust that community members have had a chance to look at these. You have no further comments or questions, I entertain a motion to approve.
I'll move to approve.
Second.
So moved by Supervisor Vigas, second by Supervisor Berg. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Carries unanimously. Thank you. We're at to resolution number 5 to approve the appointment of June Sinkfield to the Kenosha County Commission on Aging and Disability Services. Are you handling that, Laverne?
Yes.
Please come to the table. Ms. Sinkfield, please come up as well.
So I would like to introduce June Sinkfield. And I could let her tell you about herself. I just wanted to mention that she had been, we had at one time two different committees of ADRC board and a commission on aging, and then we combined the two. Her term ended on the ADRC board, and then we combined the two groups into one, to the Commission on Aging and Disability Services. During this period that she's been off of the board, she continued to serve on our quality subcommittee, regularly attending meetings, and June has huge list of volunteer activities that she's about. I'll let her tell you about herself. But we would be very happy to have her back on the
show. I'm Julie Sinkfield. I'm a foster parent of Blake Quinones. He's 10. And I have a husband, Thomas Sinkfield, and one child. I'm a junior. I do a lot of volunteer work. I was retired from Pepsi. I worked for Reverend Harrington for 15 years at Second Baptist Church as administrative assistant. But right now, I'm just doing, like, we serve the homeless at Christ the King. I work for Shalom's, and all this is volunteer. I work for Kafasi. I work at both Shalom's centers, the pantry and the shelter. So mostly I do whatever I can. I get a lot of calls for volunteers, especially from Kapasi. And I just do what I can. And I am I'm the president of the mission ministry at Second Baptist Church. And that's about it.
Well, that's a pretty good background.
They say I'm all over the coast doing stuff.
Okay.
Because I do the coach with this and the toys with tots and whatever. I do whatever is needed.
Coats for kids and toys for tots. That's good. That's a good thing.
I just had the one foster child. Now I had another one, but she got adopted.
Okay.
And Blake is up for adoption.
How old is your current foster child?
Blake is 10.
Okay. Comments or questions from the committee?
I make a motion to approve.
Moved by Supervisor Berg, second by Supervisor Gable. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. See none, it's unanimous. Thank you, Mrs. Sinkfield, for attending. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
That takes care of the resolution number 5. We're on to presentation of Youth Justice Report. The second Rogers of the
yes, the second Rogers. Thank you.
The original Rogers.
Yes, yeah. No relation to the Rogers Day Tribute Program. So, thank you, Chairman Grady. So I'm Ron Rogers. I'm the director of the Division of Children and Family Services. And in every year, we do a Youth Justice Report, which looks at the work we do with children, youth, who are in the criminal justice system, either because of delinquent behavior, or they've been truanting school, and their truanting has gotten to such a level that the schools actually petition the court. And we present data about cases where youth are trying to be diverted from court through juvenile court intake services, or where the kids have been found delinquent, and then we work with them within the court services unit. And those cases are managed by Kenosha County employees, 8 social workers in a court services unit. So what I'm going to do tonight is give you a brief overview of our Youth Justice Report. You have the actual report in front of you. I'm not going to go into that level of detail. We don't have enough time. But I'm just going to hit some of the highlights. So the PowerPoint presentation is not verbatim what's in this report. It's the highlights from this report.
And I know a couple of supervisors were at our original presentation of this in September. So this will be a little bit of a repeat for you, but thank you for attending that. This is our 13th annual report. So if you're looking at the report itself, we're on page one of the report, and we're still there. So it's the 13th annual Youth Justice Report. And really the four goals of youth justice work is to hold youth accountable, build youth competencies, increase public safety, and promote restorative justice. This report's going to look at cases that were closed in 2017. And what that means is in juvenile court intake services, those are cases that were closed. They were trying to provide deferred prosecution agreements, and either youth can successfully complete those and the cases are closed that way, or if the youth are unsuccessful, then the cases are closed in juvenile court intake services and they're referred on back to court, and then those youth can become delinquent. And then the other court cases that are closed are with the Division of Children and Family Services. So the next slide, this is page two of the report. So we're going to look at 203 youth that were closed in juvenile court intake services, 191 youth that were closed in the DCFS court services. That represented 231 cases. So when a youth comes into the juvenile justice system, what they're found delinquent if they've committed a crime. Some youth commit more than one crime. They can be found delinquent on more than one file. That's why you can have 231 cases when there's only 191 youth. Okay, next slide. We're on to page three of the report. What's really been dramatic is, and we'll talk about this more later in this presentation, the number of delinquent activity in the Kenosha community is decreasing. There is less juvenile crime. So the makeup of the kids that we're working with has changed. So back in 2005, we had about 76% of the kids we worked with were delinquent. They had committed some form of a delinquent act in the community. Now, this in the 2017 report, only 53% of the youth were delinquent, and we had a much greater influx of kids that were in court for truancy issues. So that's been a change in sort of the work we're doing, meaning that the school has petitioned the court to get help with those youth who are truanting.
So is this in the past, the schools are trying to do this by themselves, and that's why we see this uptick?
That's a great question. And please, ask questions throughout the presentation. We think part of it has to do with just a change in philosophy at schools. I think they've added another truancy officer in one of the... The schools still have to do a lot of outreach. They can't just take any child that's truant and refer them to juvenile court. But they seem to be more inclined to do that. And we have success with a number of youth that are truant. I'll share some of that with you. So it's good. We want kids to be in school. We want kids to get a high school diploma. Okay. So we're on to that. So the next slide just gives you, now we're on page three of the report still. It gives you just sort of the ethnic breakdown of the cases. And it just sort of shows you that really what shows you between 2005 and 2017 is that, Caucasian youth make up about 65% of the youth in Kenosha County. African-American youth make up about 11.4% of the youth. We still have African-American youth overrepresented in the report at about 37%. And that just has to do with what kids are charged with crimes. We can do one more slide now. We can. And we're going to talk about, what are the crimes that youth do. So what this slide shows you is felonies. Felonies comprise about 23% of the crimes that are committed. And a common felony for youth would be assault or burglary of a home. So the good side of that is misdemeanors represent 3/4 of the crimes that kids are in supervision for. And so that's that is a much lower level of criminal activity. And those types of misdemeanors can include disorderly conduct, battery, retail theft, criminal damage to property. So, you know, one of the things that you do see is that sometimes kids who have gotten in trouble, you know, there is more, people are quicker now to call the police when kids are fighting. People are quicker to do that than when I was a teenager. And so that's where some of these batteries and things come in. You know, it's kids that were, that back when I was a kid in school, they probably would have thought that those two boys were fighting. And now those two boys are, the police are called to issue charges on those kids. Okay? We'll go to the next slide. We talked about truancy. I just want to give you an overview. This isn't in the report, but it is what is a habitual truancy in Wisconsin. So this is the definition. A student who is absent from school without an acceptable excuse for part or all of 5 or more days on which school is held during a semester. So you can open the door to being labeled a truant if you're a kid that simply cuts your first hour class in high school more than 5 days in a semester. Or if you're a kid who cuts a study hall and lunch period that are together. And if you're caught doing that, that you could be considered truant. So that is the Wisconsin definition. That's the definition we use when we're compiling this data. Okay, why don't we go through
this. We should mention, though, that those aren't the kids that are arriving in court.
No,
they aren't. 5 days is not going to get you into court. It's going to get you talking to somebody. But the ones that end up in Ron's shop have large number of days, if not most of the school year they haven't attended, things along that line.
Yeah, so. Yes. You're correct, John. Absolutely right. I forgot to say that. No, you're right. No, the school's made a lot of outreach efforts.
Yes.
Usually, by the time they petition the court, they've done a lot to reach out to those kids. So let's go. We'll go to the next slide. So what we're looking at here, in your report, when we look at all of the truancy work we do, we find that of the truants that we work with and that JCI works with, we have a success rate overall of about 63%. But what this slide shows you is it really varies by the age of the youth. And it also varies if they're worked with by JCI or by DCFS. So in the slide you're viewing, you can see that JCI has had real success with the age group of 10 to 12 and the next level of 10. If we reach, hit the next slide if we could, we find that once kids come into court, they're not in the deferred prosecution agreement, we have great success with basically children 12 and under. Meaning, what that means is, after we work with them on a truancy petition order, they're not habitually truant. They don't meet that definition of habitual truancy by the time we close the case.
Do we see with the youth, especially the 12 and under, that having to do with what maybe is at home, with
yes.
parents not being able to provide transportation for whatever reason?
It's often more than just transportation, but you're right on. But it's the same idea. It's often it involves more of a home that's maybe hasn't had a long. The parents maybe weren't great students. They don't really see it as such a concern, or there's a lot of other demands on those parents' time. And so it isn't necessarily just transportation. It could be just a lot going on in the home and they're not getting the kids off to school. Yeah. There was another question, too.
Of the 95% and 100%, how many of those end up being the 50 or 64% later?
We haven't tracked that. That's a great question. We have not tracked that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that something that you...
We prefer to think none of them.
Yeah, we really do. We hope none of them. It's hard to track that. It is because of the ages and the way those petitions come in. We do track delinquent behavior after our involvement. I can share that with you later, and I actually have done that. But the truancy, we're not tracking that way at
is
this
it,
time.
Is it possible to start looking at doing that? Just because, I mean, maybe that's a step towards future recidivism. You know, I mean, that's kind of, in a
yeah.
sense, a type of recidivism, right? So, I mean, maybe that's a way to relate it. I mean, then we later on look to see if any of those kids end up committing crimes later on.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that if we headed off younger age, maybe, I don't know how else to add to what we're already doing, but maybe that's something we can look at.
I'm making a note of it. I mean, you're right. I should look to see what we, how we, if there's a way we can structure that. Let me give that some thought, and let me see what fits. We're able to do that. Clearly, you're absolutely right. If kids are not in school daily, and they're not getting a degree, you know, high school degree, making progress, that's how kids get in trouble.
Sure,
so when kids are truanting, especially like in high school, you want to predict if a kid's going to run in trouble with the law. Well, it's the kid who isn't in school, you know, 5 days a week like the rest of their classmates. That doesn't mean it absolutely happens, but it's often a precursor, you know.
I think the judges would love to see that number too.
Probably. I'm sure they
I got a question.
Yeah.
Are the parents aware that these kids are skipping school, or are they?
The schools do a lot of outreach to parents before we ever get involved. And so they're calling, you know, whatever cell phones that they have on the parents there. They write letters. They do a lot of outreach to parents. Once they come into court, you're absolutely sure the parents know, because the children aren't coming into court by themselves. They're coming in with their parents. And although they're on a truancy order, the judge makes it clear that they want the parents to support the kid's school attendance. The order for truancy is on the child or the youth, but the parents are at those hearings.
The parents can be held liable. Is that correct? That was my understanding.
We have an attorney here. I know libel is the exact right term, but they can be. Certainly, the court can impose some conditions. Let me. We'll switch back for a second to. We'll hit the next slide, and we'll talk about. So with delinquent youth, now we're talking back to kids that have committed, you know, what if you and I did this would be considered a crime, but for youth it's considered delinquent behavior or delinquent act. So the court can ask youth to complete community service work, and they can also ask youth to make restitution. So this is, we're looking at page 5 in the actual report. The reason they order community service work is the thought behind that is this could help build youth competencies, promotes restorative justice. It's another way to help hold youth accountable. Our judges right now are not ordering a lot of community service work, and they're not ordering a lot of restitution. And that's just been a change. And you'd have to ask the judges why that's changed. So out of all those youth that we talked about, the 191 that wrapped up in 2017, only 22 were ordered to do community service work. And 94% of the hours that they were ordered were completed in 2017. And we're real proud of the fact that in community service work over, as you see in the graph on the PowerPoint, we've continued, we've been at 85% or better in the last 5 years. We ideally want to be in the 90s. Some people ask, do you ever extend a youth if they don't complete all their community service work? We could go into court and ask for an extension. It really depends on how the youth is doing in all parts of their supervision. So if a youth is attending school, if they've been really doing well in so many areas and they're short a few hours of community service work, highly unlikely that we would ask the court to extend that, because that's just keeping them in the juvenile justice system longer. The next slide is not as good, and so this is an honest report. We did very poorly in 17 in collecting restitution. We had only 10 youth ordered restitution. 4 of the 10 paid everything. So 40% of the youth, 4 of the 10 actually paid it, but the actual dollar amount only turned into 21% that was ordered. What we do when we have when we're not collecting all that restitution is we go back and ask for civil judgments. And those are orders that are put on the child and the parents that they owe that remaining money. So we had a total last year of $7,381 in restitution. We collected $1,574, and we had civil judgments issued for $5,806. Yeah.
So going back to the community service hour, is the alternative to that detention for the youth? Have you seen an uptick in detention?
No, I've got a slide to talk about detention. It isn't. Community service work is an option. And our judges, they seem to be focused more on some of the other treatment interventions we're offering youth and trying to deter them from committing more crime that way through the different programs that we use. And we just have not seen as many orders for it.
And then going with the restitution, does this follow, and so I guess maybe you can answer this question, but are they ruling against a minor, or is it they're ruling against the parents?
The civil judgment?
For the civil judgments, yeah.
Both.
So does that follow them then after they turn 18?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And is there relief for the parents then? I mean, to some extent, the parents do have to take responsibility for their children, but I would be remiss to say that there aren't parents out there who really are struggling with their children.
Right.
Or, I mean, is there some sort of relief for them where if they are a low-income family and they're saying, look, I'm trying, but, or is that more so up to the judges?
I would need to talk with an attorney. I don't know how they would get relief for that, if they could bring it back to court or not. Yeah. We do that at the end of our supervision. The civil judges, we make that request. Yeah. Those are great questions. Those are excellent questions. We'll go to the... So the big thing I want people to take away from the numbers here, and there's these two slides. This is page 6 of the actual report itself, is our diversion rate. So juvenile court intake services, they're working with youth on deferred prosecution agreements. So the idea is if the youth complete what they're required to do, they're not found delinquent. They don't have a juvenile record. They are, whatever they did that was wrong in the community, that it goes away in a sense. They successfully complete their deferred prosecution agreement. So our juvenile court intake services achieved a rate of 61% in 2017, which is very good. Our five-year average was 56%, but 17 was a better year. That means that 61% of those youth never walked into the judges, had to go into court, never were found delinquent, and then stayed out of the juvenile court system. That's a good thing.
Can I ask then, in the juvenile intake, when the court's not involved, does your office call for the minor to complete community service?
Yes, those community service numbers included, they can be on those orders, yes. And they have a very small office, a small number of staff in juvenile court intake, so it's a real sort of light touch case management. Now, of the cases that don't complete successfully, those are often referred on into court, and those youth then are found delinquent. So I'd like to, we'll go to the next slide. And what we look at is a non-recidivism rate. And so we're gonna talk a little bit more about this on page 6 of the report. So we achieved a non-recidivism rate of 79% in 2017, which means that it really, if you think of it, that's right at 80%. So kids that were, so 10 youth were on supervision, 8 of the 10 did not commit a new crime while on supervision. That's how you keep the community safer. Now, if we look at the next slide, we have been maintaining for the last 4 years, 14, 15, 16, and 17, our non-recidivism rate has been between 78 and 79, 80% in those 4 years. And what that shows you is that the services we're providing these youth are working. Where kids are learning new skills, they're learning, we have different programs, aggression groups, to help kids with aggression. We do different interventions in the community, such as a very intensive monitoring program that monitors these kids at school, at home, in the community. We've talked to you before about our summer youth employment program. Some of the delinquent youth get jobs in that. We have a family therapy program that works specifically with delinquent youth and their parents to try to resolve conflicts and problems that are in the home. And all of those community interventions work, and they're much more cost-effective than locking kids up and putting them somewhere for treatment. And so you get good results. And the community isn't less safe by doing that. It's actually more safe because it works. Go ahead, Supervisor Burke.
Similar to my question earlier, coming from the background of the Department of Corrections as a correctional sergeant, I'd like to see the numbers or the rate of those that are juveniles that are going through our system, or our juvenile court system. Of those, how many of them end up committing crimes as adults? And I know that's hard to track, and that can take years to track, but it'd be interesting to see something like that.
We've started that just but real shorter term. So we were at that. The numbers I'm giving now are youth that were on supervision, that they've been a new crime while they're on supervision. So we looked at our 2016 cohort, and we tracked them to see if they committed a new delinquent act or if they had committed an adult charge. So we were at 74% did not.
Now,
so
what
three
about,
quarters did not.
What about when they turn 24 years old?
Well, that would we'd have to try to track them down.
And, well, I mean, is it hard to track them down, or do you track? I mean, somehow is there a way to get the programs to talk with the DOC?
A social security number or something.
It literally, to do what you're asking, literally means someone has to look up every name in the electronic CCAP.
Now, do they get
And there isn't a program that'll do that for us at this time. And so it's literally hours of work. And it's not, I'm not saying it's impossible. We've done that. We just haven't done it like out 8 years.
Now, if I look up an inmate, if anybody can go on the DOC locator and look up an inmate that is currently an adult offender, and they can see that they have a juvenile record. You can't look at the juvenile record. You can't see what the crime was, but you can see that they have a juvenile record. So somehow there's systems talking there.
Yeah.
You know, so I wonder if
that's
there's
probably two state systems, because that information from the juvenile record would be through the state system to the court process. And we don't have any access to that other than what we can see on the
scene. So what do we need to do to get access? I mean, can we have some put something together to try to...
No, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just sharing with you, that isn't a simple call on a phone.
Right, I know it's not simple.
Really, none of the county staff are allowed to see juvenile CCAP. And we've requested that for years. And we have been denied that access.
So then that's something that we need to have the DOC crunch numbers on, because they already have it in their system.
I mean, literally, we've brought that up because my staff, our county social workers who work for the Division of Children and Family Services, cannot look in juvenile CCAP.
So is it possible to get somebody from the DOC, John, to come in and see, try to push them into kind of pulling those numbers for us?
I have a meeting with a few folks next week where I'll ask that question and see where that gets me.
Okay.
On that same note, if I can just interject another 2 cents. So then your numbers actually that are so high are talking about while the kids are on juvenile supervision,
correct,
or while they're sitting in corrections, and you can't tell me if somebody from 2013 is a guy who's now reoffended in 2015.
No, I can't. We have, in every report, we've looked a year or two ahead. And so the number I just gave you verbally, which was, we look back at 16, and we were at 74% that did not recidivate. So
during the time they were on supervision?
No, after. After.
Until what?
Well, we're in 2018.
Okay. So current, I'll say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But we haven't gone back to look at, like, we didn't pull the names of every kid we worked with in 2015 and look to see where they are today.
And is that an ongoing index that you're continuing only to add to then, so you can say starting from 2016 we're going to be moving forward and checking to see if there are any real offenders beyond the time they're on supervision?
Well, the Youth Justice Report is really to talk about how our work is with youth in the juvenile justice system. At some point, I don't think it's valid to say that our intervention was a total failure if someone commits a crime when they're 25.
And I'm not here to...
I'm not saying that, but the reason I'm saying it that way is that so much of life can intervene in those years. So if I'm delinquent at 16 and I don't reoffend, and I go 5 years and don't reoffend, and then suddenly I'm 23 and I get in trouble with the police, I don't know if that's... I don't know what we're measuring that. I don't know, does that really say that we're not effective with our juvenile youth? Because what I'd like to show you, and I know we're running out of time, why don't we click over just a couple of slides? We'll do one more after that. These are real numbers. Juvenile arrests in Kenosha County, starting in 2005 to 2017, and this information's the last 5 years are in the report. Juvenile crime has just dropped dramatically. That makes this a safer community. We don't have a horrible juvenile crime wave in Kenosha. And when we say we don't have kids reoffending when they're on supervision, so if you have only a 50% success rate with youth when they're on supervision, then you're saying the other 50% have committed another crime. And so when I'm saying we have an 80% success rate, then there's only 20% of the youth we're working with that commit another crime. And if you really walk it through, there are some kids that commit one more crime, and then they finally get it. Then they start to realize they shouldn't do this. And there's this very small number that are really a danger to the community. And we used to have years ago, back in like 2001 or two, we could have 20 kids in corrections or 30 kids in corrections back then. One more slide I'll show you. We don't have anywhere near that number in corrections anymore. And that's really because of the programming we have here in Kenosha. So that's where it gets tough to keep looking at that farther down the road. I'll just show you one more slide just for the, because I'll keep going one more. I'll skip a couple of these, the income referrals. And there's your secure detention admissions list. So those are admissions to secure detention. They've sort of fluctuated, but compared to 2012, we only had 160 admissions in 2017, which again is a reduction. If we can look at one more slide. These are kids that we have two programs for kids that commit serious offenses, our Alternatives to Corrections Through Education program. And in 2017, only 12 youth were sent there in the entire year. And then actual juvenile corrections, only 6 youth were sent there. Alternatives to Corrections Through Education is housed in the Racine Detention Facility. They do. They have family contact. They have better therapy. They have much more successful interventions. Youth that go there stay there for approximately 130 days, which is just over 4 months. Youth that go to corrections stay on average an additional 2 months, so 6 to 7 months. Youth that go to the Alternatives to Corrections Through Education program, they do credit recovery there. They walk out on an average with 3 credits, high school credits that they've caught up on. In corrections, our average for those 6 youth that are listed on that chart is on average, nobody got a credit. They got 0.9 credits on average. So they didn't actually make progress. They left that facility and were farther behind. So if you're reading the newspapers, the state is talking about closing down Lincoln Hills. We support that. We don't think the success rate has been very good there. We think that some of the ideas that are in the Alternatives to Corrections Through Education program will be incorporated in the new facilities that are going to get built around the state. Racine is looking to be one of those sites. They run the Alternatives to Corrections Through Education program. They've shown much better results. And the recidivism rate, kids that left the ACE program 82% did not recidivate. The six kids that went to corrections, three did. So 50% did recidivate. So like in every measure, the ACE program did better. So I think that those are good programs that are out there. And that's really to work with the really deep end youth. And I think the big thing to take away from this is that I'm talking about 12 and 6 is 18 youth were sent to this type of a locked facility out of 191. Those 191 didn't need that type of intervention. And the most of those kids that didn't need that intervention didn't commit crimes again. So this working in the community, working with the family, working with the schools closely, here in the community, we have much better success. And these intense programs, these are for the really significantly troubled youth that have a real significant problems. And they're in a locked facility because probably someone felt they may be a danger to the community, you know, aggressive or committing more crimes. But even with that group, with new programming, newer ideas, which are in the ACE program, were successful. And so I think the revamp of corrections that is going to happen, and that's legislated by the state, is good. It's going to be good for Kenosha. Yeah. So with that said, I would sped through everything because I know you've got another meeting to go to, but if anyone has a few more questions, be happy to entertain them.
Can we take a look at page 5 for just a second?
Sure.
Bottom lower right, percentage of restitution collected. Can you say any type of rationale why 2017 was, you know, just abnormally low in the
restitution? That's an excellent question. I looked at that, and I had there were 10 youth ordered, and I asked to see the records of the 6 youth that did not pay their share. And there was no clear rhyme or reason. It's something we have to do better on.
So the sample for 2017 was 10 youths?
Yeah, it was just 10.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very small group of kids that were ordered that.
Is it traditionally a very small group?
It's become smaller every year. Yeah.
What about in 2018? Do you have any preliminary numbers on that?
I don't have those with me. No, I don't. But we will have them by the time the report's ready.
Other committee member comments, questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for all the good questions. Excellent.
Committee members' comments. Any committee members have a comment? I have a comment, and it's about our next meeting. Next meeting would be scheduled to meet a Tuesday, first Tuesday of next month, which turns out to be an election day. So we'll not be having our meeting that is currently scheduled for the following day, which is a Wednesday, at the 6:15 usual time, preceding the county board meeting, which will also happen on the 3rd of next month.
We'll do it at 6:15.
6:15. Same bad time, same bad station.
Same room.
Different issues?
Hopefully there will be some different issues. Isabella's going to bring us 3 or 4 fresh issues when she comes, right?
Some what?
Fresh issues.
Oh, yeah. I'll bring them.
I think that wraps it off. I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We stand adjourned until next month. Thank you.
Who made that motion real quick?
Oh. I have a quick comment.
Yes.
So, as you might know, I go to Schrumper. And I'm the director of community service on exec board there, and we run the largest blood drive in Wisconsin, which is happening next week Thursday. So if you're interested in donating, we're expecting over 600 donations. So we accept walk-ins. It's at Schrumper High School.
What are the hours of your blood drive?
7 a.m. until 7 p.m.
I've donated, I think, twice to the Trumper one.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of people.
That 1 year, so I was
hooked up 6 times.
Despite the fact that there's hundreds of people there,
and students play such a large role in it. Like, all of our committee members work.
It's
well
done.
Thank you.
It's hard.
What is the date on that?
Physically.
March 14th, so that's next Thursday.
It really is. It isn't
required to, but see, we have our